first part, I'm going to give you a quick, well, give you an outline at least of the proof of the all-force measure conjecture, so you can see how the geometric notion of in geometric attainments is actually used to get some information about the manifold. And then I'm going to sort of do the setup for the end-elimination conjecture, and then Jeff can actually talk a little bit more about the proof this afternoon. So, remind ourselves what all-force measure conjecture says. It says that if N has finally generated fundamental group, and it's a coarse hyperbolic, and just to set up notation, it's H3 modded out by gamma, then this implies that the measure of the limit set is zero, or the limit set is the entire Riemann sphere, and moreover, if the limit set is the entire Riemann sphere, the same proof gives you that gamma acts ergodically. On the Riemann sphere. And all-force original proof, I'm going to put this up here and leave it there for a while. All-force original proof made use of the maximum principle for harmonic functions, and I'll give it later, but the basic idea is if the limit set had positive measure but was not the whole thing, then you could use it to define a harmonic function, which is just defined by saying that if you stand at a point, how much of the sky is taken up by the limit set? That gives rise to a harmonic function, and that harmonic function achieves its maximum over the convex core and the boundary of the convex core. You use that to rule out the existence of such a function. So let me. Yes, in the geometrically finite case. Oh yeah. Sorry. Okay, let me just state the minimum principle, and then I'll actually really give the proof. So what is the minimum principle? Okay, and this essentially goes back to Thurston, who did it in the geometrically tame case where the fundamental group was freely and decomposable. But the arguments generalize rather easily to the general tame case. And it says that if you take some function, say it's a positive function or just bounded from below, and you say that it's superharmonic, that just means the divergence of the gradient of H is negative. And if you like, you can just think to yourself harmonic, that's all we'll actually really have to use, which says that the divergence of the gradient is zero. And then you get that the infimum over the entire convex core of the function H is equal to the infimum over the boundary of the convex core of H. And if the convex core is everything, well, then H must be constant. Okay? So what does this condition mean here? Why is this useful if you're, say, a geometer rather than an analyst? Well, if you're a geometer, you might take the flow associated to the gradient, and the divergence being negative tells you that the flow associated to the gradient is volume non-increasing. But what we're actually going to do, since we're going to try to understand the infimum, is we're going to look at the flow associated to the negative of the gradient, and that's volume non-decreasing. And that's flowing in the direction of greatest decrease. So what we have to show is if you start at some point, or at least at almost every point, and you flow in the direction of greatest decrease, you end up crossing the boundary of the convex core. So you almost always find a point on the boundary of the convex core where the value of the function is smaller than where you started. So let phi t be the flow associated to negative grad H, and the point is that phi t is volume non-decreasing, meaning if you take some ball and you float around along for some amount of time, it goes to a ball which is no smaller. And if you prefer, again, if you're doing harmonic functions where this is actually an inequality, then you just get a volume preserving flow, and that's probably the easiest case to think of right to start with. So that's how we use this assumption. There's a second assumption, which is that the function stays positive. So what does that mean? That means that if I flow in the direction of greatest decrease, it's got to slow down, right? It can't be moving at the same rate at all time, or it actually would just go all the way through to minus infinity. And in fact, what we need is just an application of Schwarz inequality, which says that it's going to take it at least quadratic time to travel linear distance. So let me write that down for you. So suppose A is a subset of the forward orbit of X. So this is the forward orbit of X. And then we're going to look at L of A, which is the length of A, and T of A is the time spent in A. Anyway, so maybe we'll just do it since it's so quick. So we're going to look at the Schwarz inequality. Length of A squared is equal to the integral of A, and we can 1 over the square root of the gradient times the square root of the gradient integrated with respect to arc length. You square that. You apply the Schwarz inequality. Get the integral over A of 1 over grad h ds times the integral over A of grad h ds. And get the time spent in A there, and that's less than the value of h of x, because this is, you know, measures the total change of h over the time frame. And so what do you get? You get the time spent in A is at least as big as the length of A squared divided by h of x. Okay, and what was our idea here? Well, we had this picture, at least in the case of a three-manifold fibering over the circle, and in that case, the growth of the manifold was very linear, right? So now, if you have a volume non-decreasing flow, which is taking quadratic time to travel linear distance, well, then you've got a problem, right? Because there's only a linear amount of volume to be taken up. Well, now, of course, it's not actually true that if you're tame, the volume of the convex core grows linearly. In fact, it can even grow exponentially. But nonetheless, the presence of these surfaces going out the end, these surfaces are going to serve as sort of narrows for the flow. And as the flow slows down, there's this constant amount of water, and it's flowing more and more slowly, and it hits the sort of region near this surface, and the region near the surface has bounded volume and is trying to flow through that region. Well, it's not going to make it. It has to turn around and go back out the convex core, because when you leave the convex core, the volume is growing exponentially, and there's all sorts of room for your water to flow into. You don't look very convinced by this. Okay, let me be more precise. So let me write down the idea. Time spent covering linear distance is quadratic, but the convex core it doesn't have linear growth, but it has some linear growth-like properties. So the flow must exit the convex core. Through the boundary. Okay. So what are actually the linear growth-like properties? Let's sort of draw a little picture here. Remember, we had our manifold. Maybe down here is the boundary of the convex core. And we're starting at some point x. And what we want to show is that if you start at x and you flow out through the boundary of the convex core. And maybe these other ends, say there's two of them, and they have these hyperbolic surfaces going out them. So this is, say, maybe S1, S2. Let's call that T1, T2. Those go out, and those go out. And those surfaces are going to be sort of the narrows for our river. So if you let, say, Z of n be the neighborhood of radius 1 of these surfaces of Sn union Tn. So now we're going to here. So there's Z1 is there. Well, the area of S1, the area of Sn union Tn is less than or equal to 2 pi times the Euler characteristic. But that's just some constant. Right, so that's where we're using the fact that the curvature is less than or equal to minus 1. If the curvature is less than or equal to minus 1, the area of the surface is less than the area of a hyperbolic surface, which is 2 pi times its Euler characteristic. And then that implies that, well, with a little bit of work, you can see that this implies that the volume of Zn is less than some other uniform constant L. So each of those, you know, so there's going to be, here's Z2. Each of those has a uniformly bounded volume. Okay. So the claim we're going to make is that almost every flow line beginning at a point x in the convex core exits through the boundary of the convex core. Okay. So I'm going to cheat a little bit because I don't want to. So suppose not. Well, what do you think is going to happen? Well, what you think is going to happen is that if not, there's some positive measure set of points that if you flow out, that you don't flow out the end, but you don't flow out the boundary of the convex core, but you flow out one of the ends. Well, let's, instead of a positive measure set, let's think small ball. Okay? That's not really correct. So let B be a small ball, such that flows in B flows starting in B never leave the convex core. Okay? Well, now let's say this is a small ball about x. And without loss of generality, we can make it small enough that phi n of b intersect phi m of b is empty for all positive integers. So that, you know, if you just make the ball small enough, it eventually flows off itself for all time. Okay. What do I want? So how much time does that flow spend in Zn? So let AN be portion of flow in Z1 up through Zn. Okay? Now, notice also here, I guess I should come clean here. Remember I told you that there was this important condition that those surfaces had to be homotopic to a level surface within the product structure? Well, what I'm saying here is that if I flow out the end, I've got to actually do so by crossing infinitely many of those surfaces, right? So it's so the fact that they're homotopic to level surfaces within the product structure means that they homologically bound larger and larger sets. Without that assumption, you don't get that. You can get if you have a handle body, you can get a sequence of surfaces homotopic to the boundary of the handle body, which leave every compact set, and yet you can flow to the boundary of the handle body without ever touching them. So it's a little bit of a technical point. Okay. Well, the length of AN is bigger than some constant times N squared. The time spent in AN is bigger than some constant times N squared by our inequality, which means that the time spent in Zn is bigger than some other constant times n squared for large enough n. Well, what does that imply? That implies there exist, you know, say, d n squared integers such that phi of n of b lies in Zn. So if you use these flow out arguments, you realize I'm sort of lying a little bit here. because the center point of the ball intersects Zn doesn't mean the whole ball intersects Zn, but you can divide it up into chunks and make some careful argument. But what does that tell you? Each of these balls has a volume at least as big as the volume of B. That implies that the volume of Zn is bigger than dn squared times the volume of B, which is bigger than some other constant times n squared. Well, but this had bounded volume. The contradiction. And what this, I also said that if the convex core is everything, then the function must be constant. Well, you think about it, suppose out every end there are these narrows. You've got a flow. It's trying to flow out the first end. There's narrows. It tries to flow out the second end. There's narrows. It tries to flow out the third end. There's narrows. It can't go anywhere. Therefore, it must not have flowed at all. If you didn't flow at all, you're a constant function. Okay. No, this is, so AN are the set of time, AN is the set of times where the flow at X lands in Z1 up to Zn.
Yeah, right, but then you're saying that Zn squared integers lies just in Zn.
Oh yeah, this is a lie. Yeah, this is not quite true, really. Yeah. Well, no, see, notice what I, you know, if the time spent in the first n is growing like n squared, the time in the nth is also must be growing like n squared on average. Oh, maybe you're right, yeah. You make a good point. Okay. Yeah, no, good point. There we go. Doesn't hurt us any, but you, yeah. Okay. Okay, so let's give the proof. How does this prove all fours measure conjecture? M- mean, another sort of simple case you could think about is for this line is, suppose you think about a closed manifold. This is really an argument that every positive superharmonic function on a closed manifold is constant. It's sort of, that's the baby version of this argument. You've got a flow, this ball is flowing off itself for all time. You get infinitely many balls, but there's only finite volume. Okay. So, what we're going to do is suppose the measure of the limit set does not equal to zero, and also the limit set is not equal to the Riemann sphere. Well, that implies that the measure of the complement, oops, I guess I switched notation on you, of the complement of the limit set is also not equal to zero, because the limit set is closed, so if it had full measure, it would be the entire Riemann sphere. And then we define a function to be the visual measure of the limit set viewed from x. So what you do is you paint the limit set blue and leave the rest of the thing white, and you stand at your point, and from the point of view of hyperbolic geodesics, you look off into the sky, and you say, what percentage of the sky is blue? So if you prefer, this also equals the integral, 1 over 4 pi times the integral of, see if I can get this wrong too, 1 minus x squared, x minus c squared, squared dc. So there's some hideous formula. If you like, you can use that formula to check that our function is actually harmonic. Okay. Okay, fair enough. You can always do this. But what does H look like on the complement of the convex core? So the first claim is that H of x is at most 1/2 on the complement of the convex hull of the limit set. Well, what's the picture? So if you've got some convex set and you're some point outside it, then when you project down onto the convex set, you can form sort of a little, there's an entire half, that gives you a support plane to the projection, or you get an entire half plane containing x, which doesn't intersect the convex hull of the limit set. Well, but that means that if you look out into the nighttime sky in an entire half plane of directions, you don't see the limit set. So you only can see, only at most half your sky can be filled up by the limit set. So, other hand, the amount of the nighttime sky taken up by the limit set is clearly invariant by the group, because the limit set's invariant by the group. So H descends to a function H bar from n to 0, 1. And this says H bar of x is less than 1/2 on the complement of the convex core. But now the minimum principle applied to actually 1 minus h bar says that implies that h bar of x is less than 1/2 on all of n, which implies that h of x is less than 1/2 on h3. Well, but if you have a set of positive measure, you always have a point of density, which means that there's some point where the limit set is taking up more and more of the neighborhood. Excuse me? Oh, yeah. Good point. Thank you. Otherwise, I just get a constant function. Not very interesting. Okay, so if the measure of the limit set does not equal zero, it has a point of density. Nu, and as x goes to nu. So if you be careful, you prove x approaches nu, say, along a geodesic, implies h of x goes to 1, it's a contradiction. And if you want to prove this thing about the ergodicity of the action, suppose the limit sets the entire Riemann sphere. You could have this exact same argument with any gamma invariant set. If you ever construct a gamma invariant set, then you can use any gamma invariant set to construct a non-constant harmonic function. Well, non-constant if it's either not if it's not measure zero or full measure, and if the limit set is the entire Riemann sphere, then the convex core is n, and we know there are no non-constant harmonic functions. That proves the second claim. It's really exactly the same argument. So one thing just to sort of finish this off. The corollary says that if n is tame, then the limit set is the entire Riemann sphere if and only if n admits no non-constant positive superharmonic functions. So the fact that the limit set is the Riemann sphere implies no non-constant positive superharmonic functions is just the last line of our minimum principle. And the other direction, if the limit set is not the Riemann sphere, you can always find a gamma invariant set of not neither full measure or positive measure, say lying in the domain of discontinuity, and construct, using this exact same visual measure construction, a positive harmonic, non-constant positive harmonic function. And then if you hit this with Sullivan, so Sullivan tells you that you have a non-constant positive superharmonic function, that occurs if and only if your ergodic flow is not geodesic. So we can throw in, using a little Sullivan fact, that the geodesic flow is ergodic into this list. Okay. I mean, yeah, I think his statement is actually the existence of a Green's function, but that's equivalent to this. I think I said it wrong the first time. Yeah, so if you admit a Green's function, then you're not ergodic. Anyway, I wrote it correctly, but I think I might have said the logic incorrectly the first time. Okay. Yeah, there's a no there, yeah. Okay, so I think that's called strongly parabolic. Any analysts? Is that strongly parabolic? I always forget. Parabolic, strongly parabolic, some sort of parabolic. It has a name. Okay, now on to the ending lamination conjecture. So away from analysis. Okay, so what does the ending lamination conjecture say? Remember, it said that that the hyperbolic 3 manifold is determined up to isometry by its homeomorphism type and by its end invariance. And I wrote that on the board, but what I cleverly didn't do is tell you what the end invariants were. So to set Jeff's talk up, I at least need to tell you what the end invariants are so we actually have a statement of the ending lamination conjecture. So the question is here. First question is, what are the end invariants? Or as we say in America, what is the end invariants? Anyway, So we saw what they were. If n is geometrically finite, they are just the conformal structures on the conformal boundary. And we saw that this was a result of essentially Baer's from the late 60s, early 70s, that the conformal structure on the boundary of geometrically finite hyperbolic three-manifolds completely determined it. This is essentially one big application of the all-fours Baer's measurable root mapping theorem. But what is the end? So if we draw this picture we've been drawing, something like this, you're going out here. Suppose your convex core looks like that. And there's some nice boundary component there for your conformal boundary. There's some nice conformal conformal boundary component going out that end. So, well, okay, associated to this end is this conformal structure. Associated to that end is that conformal structure. And then the question is, what do we stick out there? Well, there's certainly no conformal structure left. All we have is this sequence of surfaces. Well, what are we going to get from there? Well, one thing you can get from a surface, there's actually a variety of ways to do it. You could take the conformal structure of that surface and try to take a limit. But we haven't talked about limits in Teichinger space. We won't do that. So one very basic thing is you could take the shortest curve, let beta n be, well, a shortest curve on Fn, and Baer's tells you the length of beta n is less than some uniform constant k. If you have a hyperbolic surface of some fixed genus, then it always has a curve of length at most roughly log of the genus, some constant times log of the genus, just by an area argument. And if your surface is more than hyperbolic, that inequality just gets better. So we're going to extract just that piece of information. And we're going to define the end invariant to be the limit of beta n. So the end invariant for a simply degenerate end is just the limit. Well, that's all well and good. It leaves a lot of questions out there, like what do I mean by limit, and why is it even well defined, and all sorts of things. Because, you know, there's lots of different sequences of surfaces and lots of different sequences of curves. Why should you always associate at the end get just one limit? So there's lots of things to think about. So let me just tell you what I mean by limit, and this is going to be a way of thinking about the end invariant, which is particularly conducive to the proof of the ending lamination conjecture. We're going to think about it in terms of the curve complex. So did Jeff define curve complex? No. Okay. So associated to what? Oh, okay. Well, I think I have to. So the curve complex of S, this is curve complex. Is the vertices are just isotopy classes of simple closed curves. I guess I should say homotopically non-trivial ones. I don't want an isotopy class for the trivial curve. If you take a bunch of curves, they span a simplex. If they have disjoint representatives, And in fact, all we really care about is the one skeleton of this object and two curves, span and edge, if you can wiggle them and make them disjoint. Okay, and the key fact here going back to Mazur and Minsky is that this curve complex is Gromov hyperbolic. So has its boundary at infinity. Now one has to be a little bit careful about blindly using all the facts that you think you know about Gromov hyperbolic spaces, because this is a highly non-locally compact. So you do actually have to think a little bit every time you use a standard fact here, but almost everything seems to work out. So one thing that doesn't, for instance, is the boundary at infinity is not a compactification of the curve complex. You can't compactify a non-locally compact space by putting a boundary on it. So I should say it. If you haven't thought about this before, the reason it's not locally compact is if you take one curve on a surface, there's infinitely many other curves disjoint from it. And all those curves are vertices which are joined to your curve by an edge. So while this is just a simplicial complex, it is kind of a nasty one. So the theorem goes back to Thurston, Bonahone. And finally, in this language, you need to use work of Clarke, says that lambda, which is limit of beta n, contained in the boundary of infinity of the curve complex, exists and is well-defined. Meaning that if you take any sequence obtained this way, it has a limit, and it always has the same limit. So that's your end invariant. And it seems sort of like a remarkably vestigial piece of information. I don't really, in retrospect, have any idea why Thurston might have thought this was enough information to capture the entire geometry of the end. Once you see everything we have now, you could sort of see how it should work out, but I don't know why back in the 1970s he would have thought this. So then the theorem. So... They don't have to be shortest. It would be okay. You need a uniform bound on the length. That's all you need. Once you have a uniform bound on the length, the whole technology goes through. So I didn't have to choose shortest, but it's very concrete, right? Choose the shortest. What? Well, otherwise you have no control at all. If I'm allowed to choose any curve on the surface, I can get any limit I want. Jeff's going to talk about this, but the sort of basic thing you get is, suppose you take one curve which is shorter than your manifold and another curve which is shorter than your manifold, and you take the geodesic, a tight geodesic joining them in the curve complex, then every curve in that geodesic has bounded length. But that's a good chunk of what Jeff's going to talk about, so maybe I won't go there, but it's used in a very crucial way in these a priori bounds. The point somehow is that, or one of the points somehow is, that the set of bounded length curves in the manifold is almost a geodesic joining the end invariants of the manifold. So what you're doing when you pick these curves is you're almost picking the curves that line the geodesic. That's false if you try to interpret that any precise way, but it's sort of morally true. if you think about it, what's the first thing, if you're hoping to understand the isometry type of a manifold, you have to understand which curves are short and which curves aren't. Another very basic way of thinking of it. Is that answering your question at all?
You're
not talking about the proof of the anyway, you're talking about the proof of this. Oh yeah, that's exactly the fact. That if you take two curves which are way out here and are both bounded length, then they're geodesic representatives way out in the manifold, and have bounded length, then their intersection number on the base surface is small. That's a pleated annulus argument. So you take this curve on the surface, and you take this curve on the surface, and you join them to their take this G-stick out here, this G-stick out here, and you join them to their representative curves on the base surface. So this is, yeah, this goes back to Thurston. So you have some surface here sitting in your manifold. That's the zero surface, and you have sort of beta 1 out here and beta 2 out there. And, you know, you want them to intersect, but not too much, at least in the projective sense. So what you do is you take a pleated annulus like that, and you take a pleated annulus like that, and then you do sort of an area argument. You sort of have a bound on the area of those things, and you say you can only have if you have any two intersection points, that gives you some contribution to area, and you construct an inequality, which tells you that intersection of beta n over the length on the base surface of beta n, beta m, length on the base surface, beta m, that goes to zero. Right, because the point is these things have area which is comparable to the length of those curves. Right, but what are these intersections? Well, the intersections are really only comparable. You can only, how many times can this curve intersect this annulus? Well, only really about as many times as its length, right? Its length of the G-stick rep. But the length of the G-stick rep is you know, like e to the minus distance times the length of the curve on the surface. And so you get, you're not buying it. Will you plan to do this? I mean, the point is that you look at these annuli, and their areas like much like the length. The intersections occur way out here, like the length of the curve in this surface. But the places where the intersections happen are way far away, and that area is much smaller. So the portion of the area of the annulus which is at a distance d is like e to the minus d of the area. And each intersection makes some definite contribution to that area calculation. And so the total number of intersections is like E times the number of distance times the length. It goes like that. Okay, so each of these, so I'm going to write down, you know, so I've written down sort of three major ingredients. First of all, the Mazur-Minsky theory of hierarchies of curve complex, Minsky's construction of the model manifold, and then some final work of Jeff Yair and I. And each of these chunks is over 100 pages, so we'll see what we're going to do. And so what we proved is that a tame hyperbolic 3 manifold is determined up to isometry. By its homeomorphism type and its end invariance. Okay. So I was going to give an outline of the proof, but I first want to talk about the corollaries because Jeff wasn't going to talk about that. So I'm going to talk about the corollaries, and then if there's time at the end, I may give you a brief outline of the proof to get you ready for Jeff's talk. And if not, Jeff will get you ready for Jeff's talk. So the first corollary, sort of one sort of ought to appeal to complex dynamicists, it says that if gamma 1 and gamma 2 are finitely generated Kleinian groups, finitely generated subgroups of PSL, discrete subgroups of PSL2C, then gamma 1 topologically conjugate to gamma 2, and this topological conjugacy, let's think of it as just taking place on the Riemann sphere. So you don't need to know the topological conjugacy of the actions on H3. You only need to know the topological conjugacy of the actions on the Riemann sphere, and this implies that gamma 1 is quasi-conformally conjugate. To gamma 2. That's also on the Riemann sphere. But once you know they're quasi-conformally conjugate on the Riemann sphere, you know they're bi-Lipschitz conjugate in their actions on H3. So you can get, you can really improve your regularity here. Jeff, do I want to talk about volume growth or do I want to skip it? Okay, boss. So another thing, which you'll see, this next thing sort of illustrates something about this proof. So this proof, let me just say an outline out loud what happens, is what you do is you take the end invariance and you do a bunch of combinatorial messing around in the curve complex, and then you take that combinatorial messing around and you make a combinatorial model manifold out of it. And then Yair shows that that's right just about up to Lipschitz, at least on the thick part, and we show that, in fact, that that model manifold is by Lipschitz to the actual manifold. So one of the points that I'd like to make is this proof gives more than just the abstract statement. This tells you something about the bi-Lipschitz type of the manifold. So even for quasi-Fuchsian manifolds, this tells you what the possible bi-Lipschitz models are for a quasi-Fuchsian manifold. So even in the geometrically finite case, this is giving you new information. You can imagine proving this in such a way that in some sense you would know the fact but nothing about the manifolds. So just as an indication of what this might give you is this controls the volume growth, right? Because you know that, in fact, this manifold is made up from little Lego blocks and donuts. And the number of Lego blocks and donuts are controlled by this combinatorial mess. And so if you want to sort of, say, estimate volume growth, that's just now a combinatorial argument. It's like, how many blocks can you see in time t? And you can just go back into the curve complex and start counting things. So what this, there was a conjecture, one specific thing we did with this was there was a conjecture of McMullen's who said that there should be a polynomial bound on the growth of the volume of the thick part, but we measure this distance in the thick part in the intrinsic metric, meaning we're not allowed to travel through the thin part to tell how far apart things are in the thick part. So let me be careful here. So if epsilon is less than Margulis constant, and Cn epsilon is x in the convex core such that the injectivity radius at x is at least epsilon, and then you can define the R ball in the epsilon thick part to be x in the epsilon thick part about y. So this is y in the epsilon thin part such that there exists a path alpha in the epsilon thin part, epsilon thick part, joining x to y of length less than r. So that just means we're taking the intrinsic metric on the thick part. And what we get here is that the volume of BR epsilon grows polynomially. And you can bound the degree of the polynomial just in terms of topology. In fact, given an upper bound on the genus of any boundary component, that gives you an upper bound on the degree of this polynomial growth of this volume. Okay. Okay. And if you in the surface cross eye case, you can do a little bit more. So if you have a surface cross eye, you can get it of the form this volume bound is less than some constant, depending only on genus, times r times some degree, depending only on genus. So you can say a little bit more, say in the surface group case. Well, that's Jeff and Juan's subject matter. So, I mean, Jeff and Juan get volume bounds on closed manifolds in terms of combinatorial information. I mean, it's not exactly this thing, but I mean, they get these without constructing the full model manifold, for instance. Okay, so now let's talk about the density conjecture for 7 minutes. Because I promised to talk to you about this yesterday, and I guess this is also supposed to be the big finish of yesterday's talk. I didn't get there. Now, with this statement, one particularly unexciting way you could say it is you could say A H of M is the closure of its interior, right? That's sort of it's uninspiring. But what this means really is what I said at the beginning of the talk yesterday, which is that everything is a limit of geometrically finite hyperbolic three manifolds, and that's why it's an interesting statement. I mean, not maybe because of this. It's sort of like, shorthand for something much more interesting, like when you say the Mandelbrot set should be locally connected, right? I mean, it doesn't sound very exciting on the face of things, but anyway. So, what's the idea of at least the proof given based on the ELC? There are, Ken and Juan have an approach to this which does not run through the ELC. Which runs through the cone manifold, deformation theory, drilling and filling, and et cetera, et cetera. But this was sort of, the first way it was done, anyway. So given n, some point in AH of m, what do we want to do? Want to construct with n invariants say E of n. This isn't standard notation. I just sort of made it up. So not at the moment. Now we want to do is how are we going to show that it's a limit of geometrically finite things? Well, what first you do is you're going to construct a sequence of geometrically finite things whose end invariants converge to the end invariants of n. Well, that's not so hard. You just use the all fours bears theory, right? We know how to construct geometrically finite hyperbolic three manifolds with any end invariants we want. So construct hyperbolic three manifolds, say ni, in AH of M, such that the ending invariants of ni converge to the ending invariants of N. Right, so. So you do the same thing, and say in the sense that if you take the shortest curves in the conformal structures, those shortest curves would also converge to lambda. That's one way of saying it. Another way of saying it is that, in fact, lambda is actually secretly a geodesic lamination. And you can think of these geodesic laminations as lying in the boundary of infinity of the Teichinger space, and you can just take a sequence of conformal structures converging to that. Well, so if you take one of these ending laminations, you get a simplex of projective measured laminations, and it's okay, in fact, to take conformal structures converging somewhere in that simplex. That would be one way to do it. Now, in point of fact, you want to be a little careful about what you say here, but at the level of outline, I'm not going to. The more carefully you construct Ni, the easier it is to do the rest of the proof. So step two is, that sequence of manifolds might not even converge, right? So 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 this step is convergence results in the incompressible boundary case. They're due to Thurston, and then the breakthrough in the incompressible boundary case was due to Kleindom and Soto, and then depending on how you do it, there's Laquiere and Kim Laquiere Oshika also get used. This implies Ni converges to N infinity in H of M. Well, okay, what's step three? Well, if the N invariance of Ni converges to the N invariance of N, well, the N invariance of N infinity should be what we want. And this turns out to be rather subtle, at least in the case of the Handel body. Handel body is not the easiest hyperbolic three manifold. It's actually the hardest ones, funnily enough. And there are ways of getting around this due to Nemazzi, Soto, and Oshika, that the N invariants of N infinity are indeed the N invariants of N. They have the right N invariants. Well, but once they have the right N invariants, well, the N infinity is N. Oh, here, I guess the easiest thing to do in A would be to take the ending lamination and pinch it. Take the ending lamination you want and pinch it. That might be the easiest way to do the construction. Anyway, and for ELC implies that N infinity is equal to N, which is now the limit of Ni. Now, this step is also subtle, and this is something that's going to likely come up in Ken's talk. You've got to be careful because you might think you're just completely done because we have this classification scheme. We know everything about AH of M. We know how to classify the points in AH of M. What's the problem? Well, the data in this classification scheme vary discontinuously. The homeomorphism type doesn't vary continuously, which really in this case just means it's not locally constant. And the ending invariants themselves don't vary continuously, which means that actually knowing ELC only really gives us a start at understanding the topology of the deformation space. And so Ken's going to talk about some of the pathological behavior that's been discovered recently. Are you going to talk about the punctured torus thing? Okay, so in some sense, most dramatically, there's been a sequence of sort of bumping and self-bumping and sort of weird things, but most dramatically, perhaps, in the case of the space of punctured torus groups, it's not even locally connected. So it's, despite having this nice classification scheme, the parameterization is pretty hideous somehow, or we don't even know much about it, really, I guess, at some level. So, okay, I better stop. Oh, I'm sorry. I have it in my notes. I'm sorry. So, yeah. It always happens. I'm not hating on you, Jeff. Right, so. Let's go over here. The point is that, I mean, sort of this approach, this alternate approach due to Soto and Bromberg to the density conjecture is based on the drilling machinery. And in fact, before the ending lamination conjecture proof, there was proof of many cases of the density conjecture using the same drilling machinery which is developed by Jeff and Ken. So there's a paper by Ken, which did it in the bare slice case. And then by Jeff and Ken, says that if N is freely indecomposable, pi 1, and no cusps, this implies n is a limit of geometrically finite things. And then moreover, this same sort of drilling and filling approach to density has in fact been developed into a sort of drilling approach to the entire ending lamination conjecture by Brock, Bromberg, Evans, and Soto. And I don't know whether any of them are talking about it this week or not. Can you talk about that? What? Next week. Yeah, next week. Yeah. So you will hear about that. Well, if you stick around. Well, that's a complicated one. It was done in the bounded geometry case, first by Yair and then also by his grad student Klarik and also by Mitra in various versions of the bounded geometry case. And then there's now a series of preprints by the man formerly known as Mahan Mitra, now known by sort of a variety of names, eventually claimed the entire thing, but the sort of final piece of the final piece of that preprints haven't appeared on the server yet, and so I don't think anyone that I know of has checked those completely. So I think that's being currently claimed, and it's certainly been done in some large number of cases, and I can't really say whether they've been done in all the cases or not. I don't know.